Good afternoon. So last time we started kind of looking at some selected issues in assembly, starting with AT&T and Intel assembly syntax. We're gonna unfortunately have a mix of both, so a lot of the tools in Linux like really want you to use AT&T syntax. They kind of support Intel syntax, but not really. And a lot of other tools we might want to use will really want Intel syntax. So we should be familiar with both. And if you look at examples, you'll see both. We talked about kind of general things, review of things in x86 64 assembly. We talked about all the registers and how they interact with each other, especially we have 32-bit registers that are part of 64-bit registers and the like. Make a little less hot. And we also mentioned that if you really need to look up what an instruction does, there's the official manual. Yeah, it's thorough, so it's gonna be maybe more information than you want in a lot of cases, but it's never gonna be missing an instruction or a corner case for an instruction. You want that. We also talked a bit about the calling convention, which you're basically familiar with, and mentioned that there's an official source for that, which handles corner cases like how is floating point passed? What happens when I put a struct as an argument? There's an answer for all of that. Someone had to make a choice, and it's documented. And we also talked briefly about floating point. So we mentioned that on 64-bit x86, generally, floating point uses these XMM registers, and that these are 10 or 28-bit registers, and they're instructions that deal with kind of multiple floating point numbers in one register, or just one, usually ignoring a bunch of the bits of the register. And you know, that's what you'll typically see used. We also mentioned there's this obscure thing with x87, where previously, there was historically, there was this separate processor for floating point. Later, it was integrated into the chip, but there's this parallel set of floating point instructions, which has its own registers that occasionally you'll see used, but probably won't come up in this class. But I'm mentioning it mainly so you know if you see your things referring to this ST0 or ST1 register, you have some idea what's that referring to. Those are those old floating point registers. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, not seeing any. So there's an assignment on the schedule, which is basically assembly reading practice stuff. So it's identifying how some C code was compiled, like where are values stored in that C code, what instructions in the assembly correspond to what in the C code. And also we have some simple mystery assembly and like identifying what some of the functions in there do. The intention is that this can be done by looking at kind of output from object dump. We'll talk next week briefly about some maybe more complete tools than object dump that like do additional things that you could do by hand from the object dump output that are convenient. But you shouldn't need that for this assignment. And maybe it's even not so helpful because we're asking you to do things which aren't typical. I want to figure out what this code does tasks for the how did the C code compile part. So questions about assignment? Okay, so mention some other special instructions in x86. You'll see that, like, I could tell you to look at the manual, but they're especially weird. And these are the so-called string instructions. So there's this instruction here, move SB, or an Intel syntax. I'm not sure if it's move SB or move S byte. This is move data from string to string is what it if you look it up in the Intel manual, what it is. And it's weird because I didn't supply any explicit operands, but it moves data from RSI to RDI, not the actual RSI, from memory at RSI to memory at RDI. So it does a load and a store. And it increments RSI and RDI. And you know, you can't specify other registers. It always has those registers hard-coded. And this is kind of an artifact of the history of x86, that it used to be the case that a bunch of the registers had very special purposes. Right now, basically only the stack pointer is a real special register. But in the earlier architectures modern x86 is derived from, SI and DI were very special. And this is one way out. And you can see that this, you know, this is kind of convenient if you don't think about what must be going on in the hardware to implement this efficiently, which makes it not seem worthwhile, but that wasn't such a concern when in the 70s, 80s, when they came up with these instructions. So questions on what this does. So this is still like a lot of code actually for memcopy. We're doing like this whole compare and so on. And I also wrote increment with an asterisk. This actually, you know, it's increment or decrement depending on DF, which is the direction flag. So I can actually go backwards. That's why I have a star there. But this is like still, they thought, a lot of code for memcopy. So they made it so you could do this more easily, right? We have all this, we have this nice efficient in terms of how much code we wrote, probably not, you know, maybe not in terms of how fast it runs, but we have all this code around it to like do the loop. So they came up with an easier way of doing it that is supported in assembly, which is that we have this prefix rep. And what rep does is it repeats the following instruction in a loop using RDX as the loop counter, decrementing it down to zero. I believe this might also depend on the direction flag, actually, if it goes up or down. But. And there's only actually specific instructions rep works with, but you most commonly will see it with these string instructions, which allows you to write memcopy and some other, you know, sort of common utilities like that in this very compact form. And you will see compilers generating this, which is why I'm mentioning it. Like you need, if you ask to copy a struct from a, you know, from one variable to another, often compilers will generate code that uses rep move s something. This is byte by byte. They might use something that's like move s d or move s l, you know, something larger. Some questions on this repeated? Yeah. Okay. And so there's a bunch of memory instructions like this. You know, so there's a load store version. So this is kind of corresponds to memset. And you'll see compilers like this might be how they zero out a bunch of memory. And there's non-byte, but word, as in W means 16-bit. And dword means 32-bit versions of these. And there's also some corresponding instructions for string compare. These, I would say, would be instructions you would not include, most likely, in a new instruction set. But despite that, they're recommended in modern Intel. So they're not like something people are using, you know, just because they found it somewhere in the manual. You know, Intel says, please use this. This is the best way to do a memcopy for a lot of cases. So you'll see compilers use it a bunch. Probably that means there's some special case in the Intel processors for it to make it efficient. So questions on our string instructions? Yeah. And as I said, you could look this up in the manual, but like obviously this is very, I would not expect you to easily understand this by looking up movesb and like, what's the rep? Yeah, because it's very weird. You see it done almost nowhere else. And it comes up a lot. And it's also very weird because as I mentioned, like it has these implicit arguments that aren't mentioned. So like, it's not like other mystery instructions where you can usually say it does something with that. It's not even gonna be listed a lot of the time. Yeah.
Just to clarify, does memcopy only copy one byte, and then when you repeat memcopy, it copies all of them?
So movesb only copies one byte. When you repeat it, it copies all of them. So this is an implementation of memcopy, which copies a number of bytes specified by one of the arguments. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. So another thing is I would like to mention some things about RIP relative instructions. So we can specify a displacement plus RIP as a way of getting a memory address. And as I mentioned, RIP equals the address immediately following the current instruction. And compilers actually will generate code that uses this a whole lot because it allows executable code to be placed anywhere in memory. And it's going to be space efficient for accessing things that are near the executable code. And it's on 64-bit x86, it's generally the preferred way of accessing sort of things at a constant location in memory. Now, the Linux AT&T syntax assembler, you'll often see assembly with this written. And what you would think this would do is that, let's say thing is at address 0x1234, you think this would take RIP plus 1234. That is not what it does. This basically is going to be equivalent to, you know, computing the address after the instruction minus thing, or thing minus that address. So the distance here. Next. Instruction, and then putting that number, whatever that number is, in front of the RIP. So it accesses thing, but in a way that uses the offset from the next instruction's address when this is encoded into assembly. So it's equivalent to if we wrote move thing RAX, except the encoding writes the address in a different way. Questions?
Can you repeat, I'm still kind of a little, can you repeat that again? I kind of got a little lost.
So let's say, I'll give my example. So let's say the next instruction here, this is address 0x3000, and thing is at address 0x2000.
Yeah.
What this is equivalent to is writing move q 0x1000, or 0x-1000, I should do this, -1000 RIP to RAX, that being the difference between the address of the next instruction and where thing is. So when we compute where this goes, this is going to be memory at 0x2000, which is thing. So this is a case where the assembler is violating what it usually does, which is that when you type a label, it's equivalent to typing the label's address. In this case, it is not.
And does that work if you put a different register besides the instruction pointer?
Does that work if you put a different register besides the instruction pointer? No.
So
this is a special case for the instruction pointer.
So any other register, it would do what you think it would do by adding this.
So if I use any other register, it would just add to the absolute address of thing? Yes. And then, so that's why I'm mentioning it, is that this is a special case for the instruction pointer. Intel-style assemblers don't have a way of doing the same thing with a different without this type of syntax. And I had trouble looking up what it is. It seems it varies between which Intel-style assembler you're using. So that's wonderful. With NASM, it appears like that the way you'd write this instruction is move RAX rel thing or something like that. Rel for relative as opposed to absolute. But it's probably different with like the Microsoft assembler, and there's a few other popular assemblers that use Intel syntax. So, and I don't use them regularly, so say how that works. Any questions? Yeah.
So, I mean, is there a reason why is this helpful, or when is this actually using code?
Question, when is this actually used in code? So, as I said, this is what compilers will preferentially generate.
Right.
Is this RIP relative format. Regardless of how you write it in assembly, we want to usually, it's better to use relative addressing in practice for reasons we'll discuss. Like the biggest one is that we often want to have executable code stored on disk where we don't yet know where it's going to be in memory. And this enables that. If the address is hard-coded, that's a lot harder to do because, you know, we might want to put thing at a different place in memory, and that's going to be extra work in that case. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so another thing is what the syntax for jumps look like. So in AT&T syntax, they use this star asterisk to represent a jump using getting a memory address from somewhere. Kind of the intuition here is that a hypothetical jump %RAX is not valid because it would claim we were executing machine code that's literally in the register. So we have a star to indicate it's not literally in the register, it's in the thing the register points to, based on the value of the register. If we want to do, do a less direct jump, that's another x86 instruction where we can read from memory at where RAX points and get another pointer there. So for example, this, might be the case where we have a RAX is a function pointer and we're jumping to that function, and this in this case, we might have something where RAX is a pointer to a function pointer, and we're jumping to that function. And we can also find that pointer less directly, like we see here. And this is where we have kind of a table. I guess we say RAX kind of points to a table of function pointers. And RBX is the index in that table. So questions? I'm just mentioning this because you may have not seen star or not understood when the star was necessary or not in AT&T syntax assembly. question, wouldn't it be valid to do it without the star? So I believe with GNU assembler that might assemble and be equivalent to having it without the star, with the star, which is maybe even less intuitive. But when you disassemble it, will consistent with object dump, it will consistently store a star. Other questions? Okay, so let's go through an example here. So where does the jump go? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, can someone, some people. So, someone give me a possible answer. Only one volunteer, okay. What's our possible answer? Okay, C address. That's one possible answer. Any other possible answers? So, any others? No volunteers for others? Okay, so who thinks it's C0000? Who thinks it's 90000? People? Who thinks it's something else? No clue? Okay, so let's go through what's going on here. So we first have this instruction here. So this is taking the program counter plus 1234, and that's the effective address. So if this were a move instruction, we'd read memory there, but it's an LDA. So we're just computing that address and we're done. And you might say, oh, oh, this instruction's at address A000, so we're going to add 1234 to A000. But that's not what RIP points to. RIP points just after the instruction. And so that's why I have this B here, because my assembler, disassembler in this case, computed that the instruction, you know, ends a little later. We have to take, so it doesn't end at address, you know, zero, and with a zero, it ends with something which, when we add four to it, gives us B. And so this is equivalent to setting RIX to OXA123B. So then we're going to add RBX to that. So at this point, RIX is going to become OXA123B plus 8, which is this value, which is this, sorry, which is equal, the same thing as OXA1243 if I did this correctly, which is the address of this value. So this is what's in RIX at the end. And then we're doing this doubly indirect jump. So the first indirect, remember the first, so we're going to access memory in RIX, where RIX points. So we're going to read this number. This is going to be RIX. And we're going to jump there. Jump to that location that that specifies. Because if it was just jump star RAX, then we would run this machine code. We run an instruction there. Or really, if we think of how this is laid out in Little Endian, we run the instruction that starts with that byte. But instead, we're being less direct about it. So that's how I get A. And there's a little confusion. I think it's understandable that you think, oh, we do access memory twice because we have parentheses in the star. Remember, one of these layers is for we're not executing code in the register that's being indicated by one another. That's, I think, what was missing there, is you thought, oh, we have two layers of indirection, therefore two memory accesses. It's actually a register access and a memory access are the two layers. Is that questions on my explanation here? Yeah.
Can you use double pointers in like a jump?
So the question is, can I do like jump, like double parentheses, that no, but only because that instruction doesn't have an encoding, right? So if we want to do that, we need to write it as multiple instructions. Does that answer your question? Yeah, there are like architectures that have existed which have supported that instruction, but x86 is not one of them. Other questions? Okay, so some other little things in assembly that you'll see. So one thing you'll probably see when you disassemble stuff in the real world is you'll see this NBR464 instruction. And you'll see it everywhere. And it's NOAA. Kind of. It's used to mark places that are valid destinations for jumps, basically. And we'll talk much later in the semester, but this is kind of part of one idea for mitigating malicious code by limiting where malicious code can jump to. And we'll talk much later when we get to like why are we worried about code jumping to random locations, because we haven't had the background to be explain why that's a concern that we're going to have. But it is, and this is part of the mitigation for that. Yes?
Does it make other spots invalid?
So does it make other spots invalid? So if this is enforced properly, which I'm not sure has actually happened, but the idea would be that you'd have the processor or some other tool verifying that things like function pointer dereferences only go to these spots. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so one other thing that's going to come up that I'm mentioning, not because it's super important, because you'll see it disassembling things, has to do with sort of memory protection. So those of you who've taken CS02 or learned from elsewhere may know about virtual memory, this system where we can run multiple programs, we do address translation, and you'll know that these are divided up into pages in virtual memory. And x86, you know, as we know if you're taking CS02, definitely supports virtual memory. It also supports another way of doing this called segmentation. And the idea in segmentation is rather than having, as you learn in CS02, fixed size pages, our addresses are divided into two pieces, a segment number and an offset. And there's a table of segments indicating the actual address they start at and how big they are. And when we access memory, we're going to separately specify our segment number from our offset. So unlike with virtual memory, when I say we have a segment number and an offset, I don't mean we have one value we're going to split into two. I mean we have one value, which is the segment number, and one value, which is the offset, and they're specified separately in the instruction. So we're going to use our offset with our base and add that together to get the address. And we're also going to make sure that this offset is in the bounds of the segment. And if not, we'll get a seg fault. And this is the original name that segmentation fault comes from. So this is something that x86 supported in the 16-bit days before they supported virtual memory. And it's not really used today, with one important exception, which is why we're going to talk about it. So on 64-bit, this is generally how the segment table looks like, for the most part. So it doesn't do very much, with one exception. But what this means and how this works. I mentioned the segment number is kind of separate from the rest of the address. So in x86, conceptually, all memory accesses are still using segmentation. It's just usually segmentation set up like this, where the segmentation is kind of like a no-op. And you might say, but I never specified what segment my addresses were in. How does that work? Well, every access gets a segment number from one of these special registers, CS, SS, DS, ES, FS, and GS. And which one is used by default depends on the type of instruction. So CS is the code segment, so your jump and call instructions default to using the CS register to determine which segment to use. SS is the stack segment, DS is the data segment. And then we have these additional segments, the extra, vextra, and dextra, I guess, segments, the F and G, that are used for other things. Now, the E segment register is by default used by the string instructions, so it actually copies from, implicitly goes from DS and ES, two different segments, because that was useful in the old days when programs were deliberately switching segments. The other ones are only used when you specify a segment override in your instruction. Like so. And this is the form you will see sometimes in 64-bit for implement a feature called thread local storage. And to point out how this works, so here's kind of a diagram from the Intel manuals telling you how memory accesses work. And the program address sort of contains the segment selector and the offset, that's your normal pointer. This segment table that the OS sets up uses the segment selector to figure out what the segment information is. That's used to compute what x86 calls a linear address, what at least Intel calls a linear address. And that does all the virtual memory stuff you have learned or will learn in CS02. So this is done in addition to virtual memory. And the segment selector, as I mentioned, is from a segment register plus that any override on the instruction or information about whether the instruction is like a jump or a move and so on. And so there's a few ways these segments come up. So one thing that's kind of weird about how the segment system works and why it's still like really in 64-bit x86, even though we never really use it, is that this is where the OS specifies that this program should run in user mode. That's tied to this system. Part of the segment information is not just the base address, but also, does this run in user or kernel mode? So we can't get rid of it for that reason. It's actually really important for OSs to communicate this information, but we don't, for the most part, use this base address information or this limit information. That's kind of all ignored these days. But we have this descriptor privilege level, which indicates for a code segment, does it run in user mode or kernel mode? That is still very important. But there's one other use, and that has to do with these extra segments here. So in 64-bit mode, all the limits are ignored. And all the base addresses are ignored. So they're in there, but they don't do anything except for FS and GS. For those, we can actually specify a base and a limit. And what this is used as is effectively it's an extra pointer register. You can have the OS store for you a pointer in FS and GS and not waste a register on that. A normal register. And this is in fact used by Linux and Windows for something called thread local storage. So if a program has multiple threads, we might want each thread to have variables for the thread that aren't shared by other threads. And ideally, we just have a spare register around to point to that. And we just not change the register when we call functions and so on. But the problem is x86 doesn't have very many registers. It only has 16 and 64-bit. And when they were originally doing this, they were thinking about 32-bit x86, where there's only 8. So these general purpose registers, really precious. But no one was using FS or GS, so they just used it for this purpose, and it was kind of free. So this means that you can have thread local variables that use this. So for example here, I've declared a variable that's thread local. And this means that if I have multiple threads in my program, they'll have a separate value for that variable in each thread. And we can see the code that accesses this variable uses the segment override because our OS and standard library will arrange for FS to point to our current thread's region for its local storage. So questions about this idea for thread local storage? And I mention this because you'll see some compiler and standard library features, including most notably stack canaries that we'll talk explicitly about later, take advantage of this. And also, like, if I didn't tell you about this, you'd be like, what? What? What is this? You know. Because it, and you try to look it up and you learn a lot of things about 16-bit x86 that don't matter anymore. And yeah. So I think I need to like explicitly address it before using it. Yeah. So questions about our thread local storage. Okay. It also exists with write. You can also write to it that way. So. Okay. And so that's all the kind of miscellaneous assembly topics I was planning on talking about. So next we're going to talk about how executables look. And this is going to be relevant, you know, we're going to do a little more assignments on reverse engineering. We're going to talk about machine code, but kind of to talk about machine code, that's kind of intertwined with how executables look, because we need to think about how our address is filled in and so on. And also because we're going to have some assignments and some coverage of like how do things like viruses, programs that embed themselves in other programs, work. And also because we want to talk about reverse engineering programs, and there's some tricks we can do related to thinking carefully about how executables are encoded and like doing, you know, finding corner cases. So let's look at sort of programs in memory and on disk, and we'll talk about how these correspond. And I'm going to use the specific example of what happens on typical Linux. Other OSs do have differences in this, but I just want to use one specific example that we'll have used in assignments. And kind of the typical layout that you'll see for a program running on Linux is we'll have just, you know, somewhat slightly above address zero, we'll have its code and constant data loaded, followed by some space for writable data like global variables, and followed by space for its heap and a stack up here. And we might have dynamically loaded things, you know, sort of loaded in between the heap and the stack or somewhere. And this writable data, most of this writable data and the code and constants are basically copied from the executable on disk. So our program on disk is going to have this header information that we don't need to load. And then it's going to have a bunch of data that will basically just be copied into memory at that location. And there's also this segment labeled BSS where we're going to have space for global variables that start out at zero. We're not going to bother storing those in the executable file, but we'll note in the header that, hey, you need to allocate space for this. And the thing that loads our program will allocate some space and fill it with zeros, and we just won't store those zeros on disk. So on Linux and some other OSs, that Unix-like OSs, ELF, the executable and linking format, is sort of the format used for executables, libraries, and object files. And the basic format it has is that we have this header that indicates kind of the type of machine this is for. Is this an ARM program? Is this an x86 program? Is this an object file or a library or an executable? Then it has something called a program header, which primarily lists the segments that should be loaded into memory or copied into an executable from this file. And then there's data about sections. And you might say, what's the difference between a segment and a section? That seems very confusing, and I would agree. So in ELF terminology, these sections are something that primarily is there for object files that's used by the linker. So this is not information we actually need when we're running the program. It's information we need to link the program to fill in references to other files or addresses we don't know yet. And these sections kind of tell us, you know, what this section is for. Is it code? Is it data? There's something that might be combined together by the linker to create executables. They divide up things like object files so that the linker can remove code we don't need potentially when making an executable. And they're kind of a higher level piece of information. The segments are what is actually used when you run an executable. And they're designed for something that is much less sophisticated than a linker. So they just have these sort of dumb instructions that are just going to be followed, and it doesn't really tell you what it's for. You can probably guess, but there's not information about what you're loading. Just load it here, please, with these settings. So with object dump, you can list the sections. So here's sections for an executable. We have a lot of different sections. We have the memory address they're supposed to be loaded at, where they are in the file. You know, and we have a lot of these conventional names. And as I mentioned, this is not information we need to run the program. This is like for the linker or the debugger. So we have size, where they are in the file, and that, and you know where they're going to be in memory, this information. And some of these sections aren't stored. So for example, it's probably at the bottom. Okay. But some of them aren't stored, in which case these flags here won't have a contents flag. And there's some common sections we'll see, some of which correspond to things you may have seen when writing assembly. So conventionally, the place where the program's code is called the text segment, the text section, I should say. The data that for global variables that start out as zero is in BSS, which stands for block started by symbol historically. Other writable data is in .data. There's in .ro data for read-only, like constants, like strings and so on. There's a section for constructors and destructors. So in C, this doesn't come up very much, but like in C++, you can have a global variable that needs to have a constructor run. That would probably make something be in the init section. There's some stuff related to dynamic linking we're going to talk about very explicitly, and some stuff related to try-catch in C++ that you might see. And this is not a complete list of the sections as you saw from that picture before. So that's the sections, and that's probably most interesting for like debugging, but it's not what we're actually using to run the program. So if I look at a program here, I can use -x to output all headers, and it outputs that section information, and also this information on the top. So I mentioned we have our file type information. This is a 64-bit. x86 executable, and we have the start address. So after this is loaded into memory, this is saying we should jump to that address. But the question is, what do we load into memory? And all that information is not in the sections, it's in the program header. So here's kind of a partial list of what's in the program header, and it has a bunch of these load commands. So this says to load this many bytes from the file starting at offset 1000 in hex into memory at address 401000 as readable and executable. And the second one says to load starting at this offset 207950 in the file this many bytes and to this address as readable and writable. So we have a series of these instructions. In the case of this last load instruction, the size in the file is smaller than the size in memory, so we're going to fill out the rest of that space with zeros. And this is how the program is actually loaded. It's by going through these instructions just mechanically. And the section information doesn't matter for running the program. It's just there for like debugging and so on. So I guess I'm out of time. So next time we'll talk about looking at this executable format and how linking, including dynamic linking, interacts with it. And start looking a little at x86-64 encoding.